It's your Radio Theater Channel weekly podcast for download. The RTC for 20 great years has the best OTR on our live streaming. And continue tuning in to the Radio Book Channel, along with the RTC Music Channel, all at oldtimeradiolisten.com.
Hello and welcome back to the RTC Weekly Download, if you've been with us before. And if you haven't, well, you're in for some treats here. We're going to have some great old-time radio for you to listen to today. First, we'll descend down into the Inner Sanctum with Raymond, your host, for a program called Killer at Large from 1950. In about 30 minutes' time, it's a little detective police action with Philip Marlowe. We'll tell you about that when we get there. Right now, Inner Sanctum and Killer at Large.
Good evening, friends of the creaking door. This is your host to welcome you into the Inner Sanctum. Come on in. Come in, whoever you are, whatever you are, whether you're alive or dead. In fact, the deader you are, the more we like you. Some of us have gotten the arts and crafts rage. You know, the urge to make and unmake things with our bare hands. Gadgets and copper, silver, and bone. So striking they make your head roll. One character drove himself into such a creative frenzy, he worked himself right back into the grave. I won't tell you who or what he is, because sooner or later you'll surely be seeing him around. And now for tonight's torment, Killer at Large. Tonight's drama is the story of the short and unhappy life of a fugitive whose sullen face stares at us from hundreds of police posters. Read one. Mark Stribling, wanted for murder. Warning, this man is armed and dangerous. Is he guilty? Let's get our answer from Mark Stribling.
Not guilty. I was framed, but good. Could happen to anybody. Come home unexpectedly to the wrong kind of wife. Your key's hardly in the door when there's a scream and a shot. Helen! Helen! But it's all over for Ellen. And for you, too. The killer's gone down the fire escape, and so you're the patsy. It's the perfect crime for the guy who pulled it. Your gun was used. The world knew there'd been bad blood between you and the missus. And there's an insurance angle. Mrs. Stribling is worth $10,000 to you dead. The cops won't forget that. There's enough circumstantial evidence to burn you. So you run. You don't face the music. You don't dare. You hide and drift all the time looking for Mr. Other Man. I found him. 6 months and 10,000 miles later in a tourist town over the border. I found him in a club called the Casa Real. I got behind him and rammed a gun into his back.
Who?
Guess who, Davis? Don't turn around and don't stop smiling. Stribling in person. I got a message for you from Mrs. Stribling. She wants you to join her as fast as you can go.
Stribling, no, don't.
The long chase was over. I'd gotten my man. I ditched the gun and got away without being identified. I'd won, and I'd lost. I was really wanted for murder now. I got off the streets into another club, one with a jukebox that talked United States this time. I wanted to forget murder. I wanted to find a girl and find something to laugh about. And then one came in the door, a real looker. I watched her come right at me, like she'd picked me, just as I'd picked her.
Hello. New York?
Frisco. Stribling's the name I use. And you?
Maxine.
Fancy name. Can I buy you something?
Coffee. Black.
Black coffee for the lady, amigo.
Thanks. Now, can I sell you something?
Well, it depends. What are you selling?
Blind packages like this one. For you, special. And don't be fool enough to open it here.
Fool enough? What's in it?
Your hammer's in that package. The one you use nailing up coffins. In other words, Stripling, your gun.
Is this some kind of gag?
No.
Where'd you get the gun from?
Out of the ash can I saw you throw it in.
Why?
That's a long story.
Why?
I want somebody to confide in, somebody I can trust.
Trust with what?
I'll tell you some other time. Come see me tomorrow morning, room 110, the Hotel Chico. Bye now.
I didn't wait for tomorrow morning. You don't when you're suddenly sitting on a keg of dynamite labeled Maxine. I followed her out instead and tailed her through the streets. I didn't have to tail her far, just about 10 blocks to a club I recognized. The Casa Real. I'd run out of it only an hour ago with a smoking gun in my hand. I didn't wait until morning to go to Maxine's room in the Hotel Chico. I went right to it to wait for her, to surprise her. I didn't bother going up the usual way. I went up by way of the fire escape in the back. I found room 110. The window was sealed tight. I had to kick it in. Inside, I found an easy chair and a deck of cards. I played solitaire with my gun in my lap. Waiting for Maxine. Morning was an hour old when Maxine came home. She had a camera slung over her shoulder, a big one, like she made picture taking a business. She saw me and didn't bat an eyelash.
How's your solitaire game?
I'm ahead. Don't you come home nights?
I work nights.
What at?
With this camera? I've got the picture-taking concession in the Casa Real.
You saw me shoot somebody in there?
I did.
Then you followed me out. That's how you came to fish my gun out of that ash can, huh?
That's right.
Why'd you really trail after me to return the gun?
To get an idea across to you.
What idea?
That I own you from now on. Body and soul and gun. Here's my life insurance policy.
A picture?
Pop your eyes over it, killer. It's my life insurance and your death warrant. You were fast on the trigger in the Casa Real last night, but I worked with a fast camera lens.
How many prints of this have you got?
Just the one you're holding.
Doesn't flatter me. Where's the negative?
In an envelope addressed to the police. To be delivered if...
If what?
If a friend holding it doesn't see me around for a while and gets to think I've been murdered for taking pictures.
What are you after?
Money. Ever dream of having all the money in the world?
Not enough to lose any sleep. Where do we get all this money?
Deep into the interior. And from there, a week's climb on foot with a mule pack. Climbing Monte Muerto.
Monte Muerto. That's a lot of climbing. The mountain goes up 14,000 feet.
We'll climb it.
Who's got all that money up there?
An old hermit. An American originally. Ever hear of Teacher Jonas?
Never.
Neither had I until I went to a library. Teacher Jonas was a multimillionaire Oklahoma oil man once. Back in 1914, before we were born, oil poured for him like rain from heaven. And then a plague killed his family, his wife, his mother, his daughter. Right after that, his only son committed suicide.
Guy blows his top when hard luck piles on like this.
Yeah, that's just what happened to Teacher Jonas. His mind cracked.
Oh. So he took himself out of the world. He packed up and climbed out as high as he could get.
Teacher Jonas came to Monte Muerto with everything he owned converted into cash, into gold. He's up there somewhere, dribbling an old lunatic of 80 with more money than he can count.
How'd you tumble to Teacher Jonas?
listening in on table talk at the Caserial. A tramp pilot named Wiley Scott was boasting to a companion, a ship's cook from Veracruz named Genesee. Wiley was trying to get Genesee to stake him to provisions, a pair of mules and a guide.
How'd Wiley find out about Teacher Jonas?
He piloted a monoplane on a run from Tampico to San Jose in Guatemala. The plane developed engine trouble, and he had to make a forced landing. You can guess the rest.
How do we find Teacher Jonas?
And while he got his plane repaired, he flew over Montemuerto again and made a detailed map. Map making's his business. He carries the map in a pouch around his middle.
Job number one scheduled for me, huh? I'm to get the map from Wiley. Maxine laid out the strategy for surprising Wiley Scott. She was going to invite herself up, a decoy, with me behind her. It worked just like that. Wiley opened the door.
Nice of you to visit, Maxine. A real nice...
Close your mouth, Wiley, and get back inside. Inside.
What do you want?
Tell him, Maxine.
The map of Montemuerto.
The map?
Pull your shirt out and unbutton that money pouch.
Sure.
Drop it on the table. See if the map's in there, Maxine.
It's in there.
Look, you people, I'll be glad to cut you in this more than enough for everybody. There's too much there for one man to keep...
Shut up.
The lady says no deal.
Now, Stribling.
No, no, I don't mind a minute.
Picture that, will you? Since Maxine became a camera fiend, Stribling's become a horribly negative guy. She caught him acting the killer and liked the show so much she ordered a repeat performance on Wiley Scott, The Treasure of Monte Muerto. Now she's got him climbing the highest mountain. But let Stribling tell us what gives, besides his mind, as he bushwhacks his way to the peak of Monte Muerto.
We were about a day out with the wind in our faces, maybe 4,000 feet up Monte Muerto with 10,000 more to go. We had two mules along packing provisions. We also had a guide we bought ourselves in a village, a local character named Stefano, whose face spelled trouble. We needed him for map reading, but he'd need watching.
Senor, nice Stribling.
Yes, Stefano.
The wind blow like a hurricane. Better we camp here.
And lose time? What's wrong with a little wind?
Stefano's right. We try circling that ledge, the wind will blow us off the mountain, mules and all. We'll make camp here.
In this marsh?
Better than the ledge. At least here we're not exposed.
Now, try telling that to the snakes.
We'll build a fire. Make camp, Stefano.
Si, senorita.
The order of the day, huh?
Get used to taking orders. And don't ever point your gun my way by mistake. Killing me is like committing suicide.
We made camp and got a fire going. And within an hour, the wind let up as suddenly as it began. Monte Muerto was like that. And then riding out with the wind as it blew up trail toward the peak, came a shout.
Hello!
Hear that, Maxine? Somebody calling to us from down trail.
Shh, let me listen.
Hello!
One thing, we haven't got the mountain to ourselves.
That voice. I've heard it somewhere.
Can you make out where and who?
Hello!
Yes. It's that ship's cook from Veracruz. Genesee. The one Wiley Scott was trying to get a steak from that night in the Caserial.
Must have seen the smoke rising from our fire. What do you suppose Genesee's on the mountain for?
One guess.
He pumped Wiley Scott like you did, huh?
And he's out to make it in his own, like we are.
But he doesn't make it, eh, Maxine? When he appears, you order me to give him what Wiley got.
No. Not when he appears. Not with Stefano here watching. You go down to Genesee instead.
I hurried through the brush. And then after a ways, I slowed down. Stalking. Like a hunter stalks. There was no sound now except birds screeching. No sound of Genesee. And then, all of a sudden, I heard all the sound Genesee had in him.
Help! She was screaming somewhere in the trail, screaming like a guy gone crazy with fright. I cut in the direction of the screams as fast as I could go.
I reached to where Genesee figured to be. But there was no Genesee. Only a pack mule at the edge of what looked like a shimmering bed of hot sand. Quicksand. It looked like Genesee had fallen in. All that was left of him was a hat sitting on the edge. But as it turned out, that was what Genesee wanted me to say.
God! Stop!
It came to. And my left hand smashed where a bullet had burned into it. And Genesee, looking down on me, he'd been squatting in the brush with his rifle aimed and ready.
You're not very bright, my friend. You fool easy. That hat on the edge of the quicksand was only a stage setting.
How could you know I was coming down after you?
Oh, these field glasses. I saw you make camp up there off the ledge and then come down trail after whispering with Maxine. I guessed you were coming down to kill me.
Maybe not.
Don't lie to me, my friend. I know Maxine. Roll.
Roll?
Into the quicksand. I ain't got any bullets to waste. Roll.
Okay. Okay, if you want it like that. I rolled, slowly. I was darn sure, but Genesee wasn't very bright either. Rolling, my good hand under me closed on the 38. A 38 and a shoulder holster. Coming up on the roll, a shot from the hip. Genesee never even knew what hit him. I got back to camp. Maxine was all smiles. She washed my hand and tied it up. Then we all turned in for the night. The last thing in my ears was Stefano snoring. And then the fever throbbing in my hand rose to my head and I passed out. I came to wondering why Stefano wasn't snoring anymore. It wasn't because he was awake, up and about, packing the mules like a guy making a sneak getaway in the night. I reached for my gun. No gun. My gun was gone.
I see you are awake, Senor Stribling.
Good thing. Quiet.
Well, awake the senorita. Please do not do nothing foolish, senor. Stefano does not want to harm you and the charming senorita.
What does Stefano want to do?
To take the mules and himself to the senor teacher, Jonas.
What do you know about teacher Jonas?
As much as you do, senor. You see, the senor Wiley Scott also tells Stefano everything when he asks Stefano to work for him. He's a guide to the top of Monte Muerto. Adios now, senor Stribling. You have a long way to go.
Stefano had left us to what seemed sure death. Either starvation, one of those sudden quicksand beds, an animal, or a snake. But we kept pushing on, Maxine and me. 3 nights and 2 days. With Maxine breaking into laughing jag after laugh. Now it's so funny.
You. The tender way you're keeping me alive and
sad. I've got to keep you alive.
Even if it chills you to do it. You hate me, don't you, Stripling?
I'll give you one guess.
If you only knew where I'd left that negative.
I'll know. I'm keeping you alive, sure, just about. But that mud water you've been drinking and the rotten food, you'll catch yourself a fever on it sooner or later, and then you'll talk. You'll rave with fever, and before you know it, you'll let on where you left that negative. When that happens, I'll kill you. But I had an exclusive on fever. My head was swimming in it. My hand. The hand Genesee shot. I wanted to cut it off. And then what seemed a half day from the peak, we ran into Stefano again. Maxine saw him first.
Jimmy. Look.
Where?
Up there, hanging from the tree.
What? Stefano. It was Stefano, strung up by the neck and grinning like he knew the joke was on him. I cut him down. The $64 question of who strung Stefano up was answered in a note pinned to his clothes.
What does the note say?
I'll read it to you. You're next, Stripling. And after you, our mutual Maxine. Signed, Wiley Scott.
Wiley Scott?
But I shot him through the heart and left him in the hotel closet.
His ghost took up where Wiley left off.
Let me see that note.
You've seen Wiley's handwriting before?
Lots of times.
Well, is it or isn't it?
Yes. Wiley wrote this note. A dead man hung Stefano.
You get to a point where you don't figure things out anymore. You don't think, you just push on like we did to the top. Or die. And then not much further to go. Smoke. Smoke's coming from the chimney.
Here we are. It's Teacher Jonas' hideaway. We made it.
Almost. We got a good quarter mile yet.
Sibley?
What?
Wiley's up there. Look through these field glasses you took from Jesse. See what I saw?
Yeah. Wiley out front with a rifle standing side. We made it, but we're licked anyway. We show, and Wiley or his ghost shoots us down.
No. We don't do it like that. I show. Wiley draws a bead on me. His eyes are on me. You find an approach behind him.
With my bare hands, I only got one
with
hand.
A rock. You kill Wiley with the biggest rock you can find.
We tried it like that. Maxine stumbling into Wiley's view, then pulling a dead faint 100 yards away. Me crawling on my knees and stomach from the rear with a rock. I waited until Wiley bent over Maxine, and then I heaved. When Wiley came around to consciousness, I had his rifle.
I rose again, I guess.
How'd you come back to life?
That day in my room. You shot okay, but you only knocked me out. A concussion did that. I always wear a bulletproof vest.
How'd you beat us up here?
Shortcut I didn't indicate on the map.
And the old man, Teacher Jonas, what'd you do with him? I don't see him.
The old man's dead. He died this morning in his room.
You killed him?
Nah, I found him dying. Nothing special, only old age.
Your money, what about his money?
That's a joke. Old Teacher Jonas told me I could have it if I wanted it bad enough. Seeing as he was dying without heirs. He was a real old gentleman. If he was crazy, you couldn't tell.
Where'd you say he kept the money, Wiley?
In an iron trunk in the kitchen.
In an iron trunk in the kitchen. You take care of Wiley, Stripling.
Maxine, wait a minute.
Let her go, Stripling. She deserves what she's gonna get.
What she's gonna get. What do you mean, what she's gonna get? The house came down on Maxine. When the smoke cleared, Wiley told me what old Teacher Jonas had told him. A booby trap tooled into the iron trunk. Open the trunk to steal the money. And blow yourself up. I'm here on top of Monte Muerto with Wiley Scott. That negative, no doubt, is in the hands of the police by now. They're probably sweating their way up here. A funny thing. I don't care anymore. I'm not worrying about being hung. There's pain shooting from my hand into every part of me. And you tell me, how many times can a man die?
Nothing like blowing your top in high places. Maxine and Stripling reached the peak, all right. The peak of insanity. Poor Stripling's absolutely disinterested in that picture Maxine took of him now. He figures you can't hang a man for dying. Morrow? Oh, sure. I have copied this dilly out of an old edition of Callahan's Catalog for Climbers. Quote, sometimes the road up leads
underground. Pleasant dreams.
Inner Sanctum has been brought to you through the facilities of the United States Armed Forces Radio Service, the voice of information and education.
That was Killer at Large, an episode of Inter Sanctum from 1950. Now it's time for a little detective action. We're going to listen to Philip Marlowe from 1949 in The Black Halo.
Somewhere in the cold, persistent rain that made the city itself seem a thing of evil, a girl had disappeared, and it was my job to find her. But before I did, I found death and a devil.
From the pen of Raymond Chandler, outstanding author of crime fiction, comes his most famous character as CBS presents The Adventures of Philip Marlowe. And now, with Gerald Moore starred as Philip Marlowe, we bring you tonight's exciting story, The Black Halo.
For 3 days, an ugly storm had lashed at the west coast from northern Oregon to the tip of lower California. And although it was only noon when I drove up to the sprawling red brick house just south of Santa Barbara to meet a new client of mine, the black that was in the sky and the driving rain that was everywhere left the day bleak and wet and cold. Left it the kind of day that made you feel that logs blazing in a fireplace and a warm, dry robe were the only things that could matter to anyone. But when I got inside the house, Felix Drum, 350 uncomfortable pounds of executive in a wheelchair, who made his living importing perfumes, was very worried. And not about the weather outside.
Marlowe, Julia Perry is gone. I want you to find her and bring her back. And the sooner you do that, the better.
And the more I know, Mr. Drum, the easier it'll be. Exactly who is Julia Perry?
My assistant. Very capable girl, who in the past 6 months has practically taken over my entire business. She handles most of the work from her cottage here on the grounds where she lives.
Mm-hmm.
She also has some little cubbyhole in Los Angeles where she keeps her files and some sample stock.
Do you have the address of that cubbyhole?
If I knew the answer to everything, I wouldn't have hired you. And anyway, it isn't important. Hand me that little bottle.
This one?
Yes.
No, here.
Thank you.
When did you last see Julia, Mr. Drum?
3 days ago. It was 3 days ago when she left on one of her regular weekly trips down to Los Angeles to bid on perfumes. Usually she stayed away overnight, but the Beachwood Plaza Hotel most of the time, and she was back here by noon the next day.
I suppose you've already checked the Beachwood Plaza, huh?
Yes, of course. My man Ruby, the one who showed you in, has called the place a dozen times. But they only know that Julia registered there 3 days ago and hasn't been seen since.
Well, what about the girl herself, Mr. Drum? I mean her background, friends, family, that sort of thing.
Yeah, as far as I know, Marlowe, Julia has no friends, no family either. She's just a sweet but smart little girl from someplace in Kansas.
Mm-hmm. No beaus, not even nice ones, huh?
I don't think she had the time. You see, when Julia first came to work for me, she wanted to get ahead, and I gave her the chance. She made good.
Mm-hmm.
Today, she's as much my right arm as Ruby is my leg.
Mr. Drum, did you notice anything unusual about Julia's behavior lately?
Yes, and that's the reason I'm worried. About 2 weeks ago, I saw changes in the girl, Marlowe. She seemed less spry, more preoccupied.
Oh?
Yes. I figured it was overwork myself, since the end of the year always means detailed annual reports. So I made no comment at the time.
I see. Tell me, Mr. Drum, what does she look like?
Well, I have no pictures, but she's a blonde of medium height and was wearing a plaid raincoat and little circle of a hat when she left. Altogether, she's sweet and simple, if that's what you mean.
Yeah. Do you mind if I stop in at her cottage on my way out?
Marlowe, you turn the place inside out if it'll help any. Only since I'm certain that Julia's in some kind of bad trouble, you be quick and find her.
Julia Perry's cottage was strictly the 50-50 arrangement that Drum had mentioned, with one room office and the other living quarters. In the office, I found everything in its proper place, so I moved to the other room. The moment I stepped over the threshold, the white fluff that trimmed the quilted bedspread and the splash of color in the drapes said that Julia Perry had to be something soft and warm. The half a dozen quietly tailored suits that were lined up in the closet like a squad of soldiers facing right told me that she was also simple and neat. I ran through the pockets of her clothes and all the drawers and closets in the room, trying to find something that would give me a lead that I was sure I had to have. But after 20 minutes, I had found only a leather cigarette case, a package of peppermint lifesavers, and a maroon and gold monogram book of matches, the cover of which was half torn off so that I could only be certain that the middle initial was a V and that an E or an F were on either end. But since the name and address of an L.A. novelty company was on the inside, I bought the matches as a starting point, dropped them into my pocket, and headed for the door. When I opened it, I was surprised to find Ruby, Drum's right-hand man, purple scar and all, standing in the rain, and staring at me like my ears were spinning.
You seem to be a very thorough man, Mr. Private Detective.
And you seem to be a very nosy one. What do you want?
To help Julia, nothing else. There's a postcard that came for her this morning. It was mailed in L.A. yesterday.
Yeah? Dear Julia, tried to reach you at Santa Barbara 1181 both yesterday and today, but got no answer. I'm leaving. I'm leaving town tomorrow. As one little girl who fled life in Haven, Kansas, to another, I would have enjoyed seeing you again. For a bit before I moved on to who knows where. Anne. Santa Barbara 1181. Is that the number here?
Yeah. It's Julia's private business phone. Well, what do you think? The postcard, any help?
Possibly. Tell me, Ruby, why didn't you show this to Mr. Drum?
I forgot about it until just now.
You're a liar.
Well, it's on account of the postcard was delivered here to the cottage.
Which is no man's land for you?
Yeah, sort of. Mr. Drum doesn't like people who work for him mixing socially with each other.
Well, maybe a sweet kid like Julia hasn't got any use for the passes you've been making at her, huh?
Hold it. I like Julia, and even if she don't go for me, anything I can do to help her, I still do, understand?
Yeah, I understand. I'm not so sure I believe. Goodbye, Ruby. It was pushing 5 o'clock and still raining by the time I got back to L.A. and over to the novelty company. Once there, I presented the torn book of matches that I had found in Julia's cottage to a bald man with horizontal question marks for eyebrows, and who, at the crinkle of a $5 bill, tore himself away from his racing form long enough to check the files for a set of maroon and gold initials that had a V in the middle. And it was 6 o'clock before I had the answer, which was E-V-E. And they weren't initials, but the front name of Mrs. Eve Bentley, who lived in a villa at the swank Sunset Terrace Apartments. And according to the gentleman who said he knew his oats, was a very classy filly. An hour later, I was at Mrs. Bentley's front door, and while I made with the chimes and waited, I wondered just how much a guy who loves the ponies could know about women. But when the door opened, I had my answer.
Yes? What is it?
Mrs. Eve Bentley wasn't beautiful, but she was everything else, including a shimmering yard of gold hair piled high on her head, and held in place by a knot of pearls that no Boy Scout ever tied. Her face was wide blue eyes and open red lips on a backdrop of soft, fair skin. She wore a black silk jersey dress that must have been sprayed on. She smiled when I said my name was Philip Marlowe and that I wanted to talk.
Talk about what, Mr. Marlowe?
Julia Perry. Ever hear of her?
No, I haven't.
So I'll try again. What do you know about Anne somebody from Haven, Kansas?
Absolutely nothing.
This torn book of matches says otherwise. I found them in Julia Perry's cottage. Julia Perry's missing. I'm a private detective who was hired to find her, and the matches turned out to be yours. How may I come in?
Why, yes.
Thanks. Well, Mrs. Bentley, maybe we ought to start all over.
No, wait just a minute, Mr. Marlowe. Mm? I may be able to help you. Did this Julia Perry deal in perfumes?
That's right. Now, how did you know that?
Because I just remembered something. And now I'm sure I can explain why my matches showed up where
just
they did.
Just a minute. You know, whenever I'm talking to a beautiful woman, somebody's always creeping around in the kitchen. Who is it this time?
Oh, really, Mr. Marlowe? There's a storm outside, and there are windows and trees. If you put those three things together, that noise could have been a branch scratching on a glass pane.
Or somebody with squeaky shoes and a lot of curiosity. Somebody like Mr. Bentley, for instance.
Huh? Oh, I doubt that, Mr. Marlowe. You see, Mr. Bentley's been dead now for 3 long years.
Oh, yes. Well, you were saying something about the matches.
Oh, yes. This Julia Perry must somehow have other gotten hold of him through my fiancé, Marvin Whittaker.
How does that figure?
Like 2 and 2. Marvin is in the perfume business. Ditto Julia. Also, I think he mentioned her name once. Said she was very clever for a girl who looked like somebody's kid sister.
That fits all right. Where will I find said fiancé?
At his favorite bar and grill. But won't you have a drink first, Mr. Marlowe?
No, thanks, Eve. There isn't time. Now the bar and grill.
The Blue Boar.
Blue which?
Boar, Mr. Marlowe.
Yeah.
It's a very English spot over on Wilshire, opposite Arthur Murray's studio. But before you dash, do you at least have a match?
Yeah. Whole book of them, honey. Torn cover and all. And I want you to keep them. After all, they brought us together, didn't they? When I got outside, I postponed my run between the raindrops over to Wilshire Boulevard long enough to take a look behind the villa. And there, in a newly planted strip of clover lawn below Mrs. Bentley's kitchen window, I found something which was no surprise. 2 clear prints of a man's shoe. But from there on out, I got nothing more than a lot of rain down the back of my neck. So 10 minutes later, I dripped into my car and headed for the Blue Boar and Eve Bentley's gentleman friend. I located Marvin Whittaker, a handsome, hale fellow well met, in a white turtleneck sweater and riding breeches, behind a hot rum toddy in a corner booth that was pictures of steeplechase mounts against newly antique mahogany. And when I told him that I was looking for Julia Perry, he flashed a lot of glistening teeth at me, insisted that I join him in a warming glass of spirits, and started to talk, gesturing all the time with a riding crop.
Why, yes, old man, I know Julia Perry. In fact, almost did some business with her today.
You mean you were supposed to meet Julia someplace?
That's right. At 1881 Selma Avenue, to be precise. But she called me this morning and postponed the whole transaction. Indefinitely.
Could you stop projecting long enough to tell me why?
She didn't say. Of course, it's of no bother to me on a day like this. No sane man should be any farther away from a toddy than we are right now. So drink up, old boy. It'll do you a world of good.
Yeah, I bet it will. Look, Mr. Whittaker, one more question. Did Julia ever speak of a girlfriend named Ann, someone she knew years ago in Kansas?
No, I don't believe she did, Marlowe. Matter of fact, Julia never talked of anything but perfumes. Now drink your drink, fellow, before it's chilled through.
Thanks, but no thanks, old bean. I do have to run, really. It was a 20-minute drive to the address on Selma, and the rain had stopped by the time I got there. The place was one of those once-upon-a-time rooming houses that had been partitioned off into a couple of dozen 2x4 cubbyholes, just big enough for the very small businessman to fill his fountain pen in. When I got to the door and asked the scrub woman, who was a lot of wild red hair around 2 pop eyes for Julia Perry, I knew I was moving in the right direction, because the lady standing in front of me was anything but calm. And more important, she had just heard a pistol shot from the back of the house.
Yes, that's right. A pistol shot not over 2 minutes ago. I'm sure that Perry girl had something to do with it. Because when I come from inside, I saw her rush out down these steps.
Did she say anything?
I don't know. She was gone out of sight before I could open my mouth. Hmm. But I know it was her on account of that plaid coat and little hat she wears.
Yeah. Now, which room is hers? Come on.
Well, that one there with the light showing under the door.
Mm-hmm.
But it's locked. She won't be able to get in. I just tried.
Well, we'll try again for luck. It's not the best lumber. Believe me.
This is terrible. Nothing like this has ever happened to me before. It's a man.
Yeah. A dead one at that, Granny.
Did You know who it is?
Uh-huh. From the mud and clover grass on the bottom of his shoes, I tag him as a guy who was looking in a lady's kitchen window about an hour ago. But from that purple scar on his chin, I can do even better than that. The name Granny is Ruby, a guy I thought was still in Santa Barbara.
In just a moment, we will return to the second act of The Adventures of Philip Marlowe. But first, given clues, even the newest of Philip Marlowe fans can deduce the characters in CBS's great new early Sunday evening comedy lineup. The washboard leads you to the one and only Spike Jones. The bumblebee? Well, of course, that's for America's most famous non-virtuoso violinist, Jack Benny, who follows Spike Jones on CBS. The two A's, Amos and Andy, who are heard on CBS immediately following Jack Benny. So it's really no mystery at all why millions of Americans now stay tuned to CBS on Sunday nights for these three superb comedy shows in succession. Spike Jones and Amos and Andy over most of these same CBS stations, and Jack Benny over them all. And now with our star, Gerald Moore, we return to the second act of Philip Marlowe and tonight's story, The Black Halo.
Ruby's body sprawled on the floor, and the girl in the plaid raincoat running away from it meant one thing. Julia Perry's trouble was important, like life, but more like death. A half sneer was congealed on Ruby's face, and his eyes, turned waxy, still held a look of mild surprise. And I wasted some breath telling the scrub woman not to touch anything, and then I put in a call to my overweight client in Santa Barbara. He was glad to hear from me, at first.
Marlowe, well, now I didn't expect a call from you this soon. You sure work fast, don't you, lad? Have you found her? Have you located Julia?
Not quite. She's about 5 minutes ahead of me. Incidentally, Mr. Drum, she works fast, too.
What do you mean by that?
Let me ask the questions, huh? Number one, what was your leg man, Ruby, doing in L.A. tonight?
Ruby?
Yeah.
Why, I sent him in to pick up some medicine for me. Why?
Come on, Drum, you can talk straighter than that, and you better. I just found Ruby dead.
Dead? Ruby's dead? What happened to him, Marlowe?
He was shot. So forget the gags and tell me why he was snooping around.
All right. I didn't trust you.
No.
It's my policy to trust nobody until he proves himself. I sent Ruby in to follow you and check on your progress.
That was brilliant. You only made three mistakes. First, I don't need to be checked on. Second, you got your man killed. And third, you forced Julia's hand. Because it was Miss Perry herself who pulled the trigger on Ruby.
Julia? Marlowe, I don't believe that.
Which proves nothing, Mr. Drum, but skip it. Tell me, do you know a man named Marvin Whittaker?
Whittaker?
Yeah.
Oh, should I?
Well, he says he's in the perfume business.
Well, I know everybody on the coast who bought more than 2 bottles of perfume at one time in the last 40 years, and I don't recall that name. I think the man must be a liar.
So do I. Thanks for the help. And Drum, if you've got any more expendable flunkies around, keep them out of my hair. I'll call you when I've got something. Called homicide next and told Detective Lieutenant Ibarra where to find the body and who was responsible for it being in that dead condition. When the question of why came up, I admitted I was still shooting blanks. Oh, I told him about the razzle-dazzle Whittaker had handed me and named the Blue Boar on Wilshire as my next stop. Ibarra said he'd call me there, and when I got to the entrance of the place, I saw Whittaker, draped in a trench coat that involved enough cloth to rig a four-masted schooner, standing in the anteroom, impatiently smacking his leg with that riding crop. He looked positively dashing. Question was, which way?
Hiya there, Marlowe. Hey, old boy, you look upset. Anything wrong?
I may be upset, Whittaker, but you're the one that's going to spill. First, are you leaving or coming back?
I'm just leaving.
Been here all the time since I talked to you?
That's right. You see, my coat is perfectly dry.
It stopped raining half an hour ago.
Well, you see, if I'd been outside, I would have known that. But why this third degree, Marlowe? What's up?
It's a long story. Maybe we better sit down and talk it all over from the beginning.
Oh, I'm afraid I can't. Not just now. I've got a date.
She'll keep.
Not this one. It's something rather special.
Special, huh? Like Eve Bentley?
Now, look here, old boy. You're prying into my personal affairs.
Whittaker, I'll rip the lid clear off your personal affairs if necessary to get a clean answer out of you. Now, what do you really know about Julia Perry?
I told you once. Are you implying that I'm a liar?
At least that. For instance, who puts out Amir? Come on, Whittaker. It's a well-known fragrance.
Why, I don't recall offhand.
That's strange, because any woman knows Amir's a Dana perfume.
Just what are you trying to prove by all this?
That is a perfume dealer, you stink. And try this for size. When I got to that address you gave me, I found a fresh corpse there with a bullet hole in it.
A murder?
Yeah, and your routine was pat, brother. So before homicide starts combing out the snags in your story, you better untangle it yourself right now. You lied to me. And why'd you do it, Whittaker? Why the double talk?
All right, Marlowe, I'll tell you. I'll tell you this! Oh!
He was as quick as a wounded cat. The riding crop slashed across my face even before I'd realized he'd moved. And by the time the red light stopped dancing in my eyes, Marvin Whittaker was gone. I turned as the head waiter walked up to me. He studied the hot red welt rising on my face for a moment and then murmured discreetly that if my name was Marlowe, I was wanted on the phone. It was Lieutenant Ibarra.
Marlowe, you can stop beating the brush for Julia Perry. We found her.
You did? Where is she, Ibarra?
She's out in the alley here, behind the Beechwood Plaza Hotel, Marlowe. Exactly 8 floors down from the window of her room. She fell through the glass roof above the rear entrance.
Oh.
It's not pretty.
Oh.
She explained the whole thing, including that Ruby guy's murder, in a note we found in her room.
I'll be right over, Ibarra.
Okay, don't hurry.
The old story, Marlowe. When Drum finally got around to trusting her, he practically gave her his business. It was too much temptation.
Mm-hmm.
She'd been stealing from him in a big way for almost a year, her note says.
And she decided to run for it when she knew she couldn't hide the thefts any longer, huh?
That's right. That Ruby caught on some way and she killed him, but I guess murder was too rich for her blood, so she came back here, thought it over, and checked out.
Yeah. All she left behind was a little plaid raincoat and a purse over there. Hey, she was wearing a dinky hat, too, Ibarra. Did you find that?
Mm-hmm. Come over here to the window, Phil. See down there on that canopy, that little black circle? Mm-hmm. That's her hat. I sent Mooney down to get it. Can't leave any loose ends around, you know.
Yeah. Got a light, Lieutenant?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Thanks.
Hey, what happened to you? That welt on your face, Phil.
Oh, I backed that horsey liar named Whittaker into a corner and he slapped his way out with a riding crop. And speaking of loose ends, if I ever catch up with that... Ibarra, where did that stuff on the dresser come from?
Well, this out of the pockets of Julia's plaid coat. Why?
But that's impossible unless... Holy smoke. That's why Whittaker lied to me.
Hey, where are you going with that, Phil? Come back here.
I got to check on something, Ibarra, and keep your notebook handy. If I'm right, this deal is still wide open. All the way from the suicide's room in the Beechwood Plaza out to the widow's villa in the Sunset Terrace, my mind juggled a jumble of facts, trying to beat them into a brand new pattern. A pattern that had to include an object Ibarra had found in the pocket of that plaid raincoat. It almost made sense, but I needed just a little more. Well, when I turned into the parking lot at the Sunset Terrace, rain began to fall again. Thin, cold rain. I walked to Eve Bentley's door and pressed the bell. Just as I expected, it was Marvin Whittaker, unsmiling and nervous, who answered the door. I didn't give him a chance to think. I just swung hard! Okay, horseman, that squares us up. Come on, heavy, roll over. Let's see if you're carrying a gun. Okay, no gun. Now, be a good boy, Whittaker, and you'll make out all right, but one funny wiggle out of you and I'll crack your skull. It's a promise. Do you hear me?
Yeah, I heard you.
All right. Now, where's Eve? Is she here?
Find out for yourself, Marlowe. I'm through.
Fair enough. But just so I'm not talking through my hat, I'll take a look in her closet first.
She won't be in there, I guarantee.
No, but her future might be. Now, let's see. It's got to be in here someplace. Oh, yeah. This is probably it. Brown cloth coat, as chic as a pair of hobnailed boots, and still damp. And the label says the BH Company, Haven, Kansas. That does it. I've got it all now, and my chivalry just died. Where is she, Whittaker? Where's Eve?
Right here, Marlowe. Uh-oh, don't try that. I guess you really do have it figured out, haven't you?
Yes, Eve, I have. Sorry it turned out this way, because you had your points, as Eve and as Julia.
Don't put it in the past tense, Marlowe. As Eve Bentley, my life is just beginning, and now I've got everything I ever wanted as Julia Perry.
Then you're Julia Perry.
I was, Marvin.
She still is, Whittaker. At least that's what the bailiff will call it in court.
There won't be any court, Marlowe.
Oh, I'm afraid there will, baby.
You're twice a killer now, and both for the same reason, remember? First Ruby, because he saw you as Eve. And the girl you pushed out of the hotel window, who was no doubt Anne, your old chum from the hometown. She must have seen you posing as Eve, too.
All right, Marlo. Anne ran into me by accident and ruined everything. I had no choice. I promised her money and then told her to go to my room at the Beechwood Plaza and wait for me.
Eve, I can't believe this. It can't be true.
Yes, Marvin, it is true. Darling, I didn't want this mess. I'd have left town this morning as I intended if sweet, sly little Anne hadn't seen me. I tried to get rid of you the easy way, Marlo. When I sent you to Marvin, the Selma Street address he gave you should have led you to the end of Julia Perry.
Is that why you phoned me and told me to lie to Marlo?
Yes, Marvin. I was going there to write my suicide note and use the stockroom for my disappearing act. But Ruby caught me, and after that I had to work fast. But it's all right now. It all worked out perfectly. They were the only two who knew besides you, Marlo.
Aren't you forgetting little Marvin here?
Forgetting him? Oh, no, Mr. Marlo. Marvin's the one person I can count on.
That's what you think. You don't get me mixed up in this.
Marvin!
I bargained for an heiress, not a murderess.
Why, you dirty load... All right, then. I'll use this gun on you, too, because I'm getting out of here and no one's going to stop me.
But you're right between us, Eve. You can't get us both.
He's right, baby. You're not good enough to get us both, and killing just one of us isn't going to solve anything. What do you say? It's been a long night, baby. You just couldn't tell when you were late.
Want any more of this coffee, Marlo?
No, it's sludge, Lieutenant. I wonder what Julia Perry uses for a heart.
You know, she planned the thing for 6 months when she first set herself up as Eve Bentley.
Mm.
And it probably would have...
Want to check now?
Oh, yes.
Probably would have worked if everything hadn't closed in on her.
Yeah, her friend Anne from Kansas, Ruby the leg man.
And you with that torn book of matches. Mm. Incidentally, that was pretty fast figuring up in the hotel room there, Marlo.
Oh, not so fast, Ibarra. I knew Eve had those matches because I left them with her. So when you found the same matches in the pocket of Julia's plaid coat, it figured Julia almost had to be Eve.
And that left Anne to furnish the body for the suicide.
Yeah. You know, I wasn't so sure about that until I found the brown coat with the Haven, Kansas label in Eve's apartment.
Yeah. Well, I'd better wait on back to the office, Phil. Look at that rain come down. Think it'll ever stop?
I don't know. I doubt it.
Oh, by the way, here, it's her hat. Mooney finally got it out off that hotel canopy. Maybe you'd like it for a souvenir.
Yeah.
The millinery people call it a halo hat. Good night, Marlo.
I sat there a while after Ibarra left, looking at the rain in the street, and the cold coffee in front of me, and Julia's little round halo on the table. And finally I got up and went outside. Dirty water scudded along the gutter and gurgled thickly into the sewer drain at the corner. For a minute I caught a glimpse again of the girl I'd figured Julia Perry to be when I went through her cottage in Santa Barbara. Yeah, that girl was an angel. But when I finally caught up with her, a halo turned out to be black, jet black, inside and out. I dropped the little hat into the gutter and watched it go as far as the drain at the corner. And then I went home.
The Adventures of Philip Marlowe, created by Raymond Chandler, stars Gerald Moore and is produced and directed by Norman McDonald. Script is by Mel Dinelli, Robert Mitchell, and Gene Levitt. Featured in the cast were Joan Banks, Paul Frees, Peter Leeds, Jack Crucian, and Lois Corbett. Lieutenant Detective Ibarra is played by Jeff Corey. The special music was by Richard Orant. Be sure and be with us again next week when Philip Marlowe says...
A startled corpse, a blue-eyed woman, and a cryptic message, scrawled by a dingy man with the pieces of a Chinese puzzle that wouldn't fit together.
until I found out what was deadly about the orange dog.
You'll find a whole hour of fun, variety, music, and thrills on Sing It Again tonight and every Saturday, for it's heard over most of these same CBS network stations. Now, stay tuned for Gangbusters, which follows immediately over most of these same stations. This is Roy Rowan speaking for CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
That's it for this week. We'll be back next week with more old-time radio. I hope you can join us then. Till then, this is Jim Dolan thanking you for listening.